Well, good morning, and welcome to the first installment of the podcast of my story, Human Readable, that was originally published in Future Washington Anthology in 2005. I'm on the road this week. I'm in the States, and it's very nice and very rainy, and my jet lag means that I'm up very early, even for me. I tend to be an early riser, but that's good news, because it means I can get lots of work done in the morning before hitting the road and seeing friends and getting to my meetings and so on. Good week for my fiction writing. I got word last week that a story of mine called iRobot, not to be confused with Ingmar Bender's iRobot or Isaac Asimov's iRobot or the film iRobot, but my story, iRobot, has been picked up for two of the year's best science fiction anthologies so far, which is pretty cool. Maybe I'll hit the third one and make it a grand slam. And been reading some really good books this week as well, some forthcoming stuff that you'll be seeing on the blog soon. And there's something else. Oh yeah, Romanian editions pending of some of my books, which is pretty neat as well. So all in all, it's been a good week, enjoying life as a freelancer so far. And thank you very much for all the nice stuff you had to say about Anda's Game. Now on to Human Readable. This is one of my very favorite stories. I wrote it originally for an anthology that was delayed, so I ended up selling it to a different one. It was a real departure for me. It was the first story I ever wrote from a female point of view, and it was a story that dealt, I thought, well with a subtle technological issue that was off of most people's radar at the time. I hope you like it as much as I did. It's quite long, and it'll be probably in about 8 or 9 installments. I'm still recording it. But I've got like 7 in the can, so that should take us for a couple of weeks at least. Enjoy it. Bye. Human Readable by Cory Doctorow. Part 1. Nice networks don't go down. It was unthinkable that the invisible ants that governed all human endeavor should catastrophically fail. But fail they did, catastrophically, on the occasion of Trisha's 8th date with Rayner. It took 19 seconds for the cascade of errors to slow every car on the interstate to a halt, to light up the dashboard with a grim Xmas tree of errors, to still the stereo and freeze the tickers of information and context that they had come to think of as the crawling embodiment of the colony that routed all the traffic that made up their universe. "We are going to be so late," Rayner said, and Trish swiveled in her seat to look at him. He was fretting again, his forehead wrinkled and his hands clenched on the steering wheel. When they traded massages, third date, she'd rubbed at his hands. She'd found them tensed into claws that crackled with knuckle fluid when she bent each finger back and rubbed sandalwood-scented oil into it. He was mighty cute for a neurotic. At least he knew it when he was being nuts. Not that he'd stop being nuts, but he'd cheerfully admit it. "We are not going to be late," she said. "We just need to manually write ourselves out of the dead spot and get back on the grid, and we'll be on our way. We've got plenty of time." "Dead spot?" "Yeah," she said. His forehead wrinkles were looking more Klingon by the second. "Dead spot." She forced a chuckle. "You didn't think the whole world was down, did you?" He relaxed his knuckles. "Course not," he said. "Dead spot. Probably ends up at the turnoff." "Right," she said. "We need a map. I'm Navigatrix. You're pilot. Tell me where your maps are, then get onto the shoulder and drive straight." "Where my maps are? Jesus, what century do you live in? My maps are with the sextant and sundial between my leeches and the obsidian sacrifice knife." She laughed. "Okay, pal, I'll find a Michelin, you drive. Every car has a couple maps. They self-assemble from old Happy Meal boxes." She pulled the glove compartment, opened the glove compartment and started rooting through it while he pulled onto the shoulder and gunned the tiny two-seater along with it. "This is so illegal," he said. "Nah," she said. "I'm pretty sure you're allowed on the shoulder when the routing goes down. It's in the written test manual. Learned it while I was helping my little cousin Lily study." "Aha," she said, holding something up. "You have a cousin named Lily? That's uniquely horrible." "Shut up," she said. "Look at this." It was an old-fashioned phone of a certain handsome retro line that made it look like a dolphin fucking a silver dildo, the kind of thing marketed to old people who wanted a device with all its affordances constrained to collapse the universe of all possible uses for things that fit into your hand into the much smaller universe of, say, a cell phone. Yeah, my mom left that behind a couple years ago. I looked everywhere for it, but couldn't find it. She must have been snooping in the glove box. Serves her right. So what? So these things can unmesh and talk straight to a tower at long distance, can't they? I don't know, can they? Oh, yes, they can. Which means that they work in dead spots, so we can call and get directions. You think you're pretty smart, huh, Dumpling? She put her finger to her temple and made an adorable, frowny, thinky face, and held it until he looked at her and laughed. They discovered their ability to make one another laugh when he'd farted while taking off his kilt, second date, and had reflexively swung the hem back to make it appear that his mighty gust was ruffling the pleats. "So what's your mom's number?" she said. He recited it, and she tapped it in. "Hi there, this is Trish, Rainer's friends? We're on the way, but the grid's down or something. The car doesn't have any nav system, the Dolby's out, the interstate's a parking lot. Oh, you too? God, wonder if it's the whole country. So we need directions from San Luis Obispo to the cemetery, if possible." "Well, yes, it's very venti nice to be meeting you," she said. "I've heard a lot about you, too. Yes, I'm giving directions, he's driving. Oh, that's so sweet of you. Yes, he does look like he's going to scrunch his forehead into his upper lip. I think it's cute, too. Right, got it, left, then right, then left, then a slight left, then up the hill. Got it. Whoops, that's the Duracell, better go. Soon, yes, whoops." "So," he said, "so your mom sounds nice. You got the directions?" "She gave me the directions." "So you know where we're going?" "I don't have a single solitary clue. Your mother gives terrible directions. Pull off at the next exit and we'll buy a map. We are going to be so late. But now they know we're late. We have an excuse. You stop fretting." Once they were on the secondary roads, the creepiness of the highway full of stopped cars and crane-necked drivers gave way to a wind-washed, suffing silence of waves and beach and palms. Trish rolled down the window and let the breeze kiss the sweat off her lip, watching the surfers wiping out in the curl as the car sped toward the boneyard. "Are you sure this is the kind of thing you're supposed to bring a date to?" "Yes," he said, "don't fret. That's my job." "You don't think it's even a little weird to be taking a girl to a cemetery on a date?" "We're not burying anyone," he said. "It's just an unveiling." "I still don't get that," she said. "I keep picturing your mom cutting a ribbon with a giant pair of gold scissors." "Right, let's take it from this top," he said, "and you better not be getting me to talk to stop my fretting, because appealing to my pedantic nature to distract me is a very cheap trick." "I'm fluttering my eyelashes innocently," she said. He laughed and stole a hand through the vent in her apron trousers and over her thigh. "Achtung," she said, "eyes on the road, hands on the wheel, mind in the gutter, this instant." She put her hand over his, and he put down the pedal. His hand felt nice there. Too nice for only 8 dates and 20-some phone calls and about 100 emails. She patted it again. "This is kind of fun," he said, as they zipped past some surfer dudes, staring glumly at their longboards displays, their perfect tits buoyant and colored like anodized aluminum with electric-tinted sun paste. "Ahem," Trish said, squeezing his hand tight enough to make his knuckles grind together. "You were about to explain tombstone unveiling to me," she said, "when you got distracted by the athletic Twinkies on the roadside. But I am sweet-natured and good and forgiving, and so I will pretend not to have seen it, and thus save us both the embarrassment of tearing out your eyelets of logarins, all right?" She fluttered her eyes innocently in a way that she happened to know made him melt. "Explaining, yes, okay, remember, I'm not particularly Jewish. I mean, not that my parents are either. They're just Orthodox. They don't believe in God or anything. They just like biblical law as a way of negotiating life. I renounced that when I dropped out of yeshiva when I was 12, so I'm not an authority on this subject." "Let the record show that the witness has declared his utter ignorance," she said. "But I don't get this atheist Orthodox thing either. Just think of them as Mennonites or something. They find the old way to be a useful set of rules for navigating the universe's curves. God is irrelevant to the belief. So they don't believe in God, but they pray to him. Yeah, he said. The surfers were all coming in now, jiggling their boards and rebooting them and staring ruefully at the radical cutback off the lip dude, gnarly, as they plodded up the beach. The ritual's the important part, thinking good thoughts, having right mind. It's good advice, most of it. It doesn't matter where it comes from or how it got there. What matters is that if you follow the law, you get to where you're going in good time with little pain. You don't know why or how, but you do. It's like following the ants, she said, watching the stop-and-go traffic in the other direction. Don't know why they tell us to go where they do, but they do, and it works. Well, I guess, he said, using the tone of voice that told her that he was avoiding telling her how wrong she was. She smiled. Anyway, the thing about Jews, ethnic Jews, cultural Jews, forget the religion here, is that we're pretty much on the melodramatic end of the grieving scale. We like to weep and tear at our hair and throw ourselves on top of the coffins, right? So there's like 5,000 years of this, and during that time, a bunch of social scientists, aka rabbinical scholars, have developed a highly evolved protocol for ensuring that you grieve your dead enough that you don't feel haunted by guilt for having failed to honor them, but not grieving so much that you become a drag on the tribe. So when someone dies, you bury him right away, usually within 24 hours. This means that you spend an entire day running around like your ass was on fire, calling everyone, getting the word out, booking last-minute travel, ordering in from the caterers, picking out a box, fielding consoling phone calls, getting the rabbi on the phone, booking the limo, so much crap that you can't even spare a second to fall to pieces. And then you bury him, and while you're at it, your family extrudes a volunteer to go over to your house and take all the cushions off of one of the sofas, hang sheets over all the mirrors, and set out enough food to feed an entire state, along with an urn of Starbucks the size of an oil drum. Before the service starts, the rabbi gives you a razor blade, and you slash a hole in your lapel so that you've got the rent in your heart hanging out there in plain sight. And once you get back home, you spend 7 days grieving. You pray 3 times a day with a quorum of 10 men facing east and singing the Kaddish, this really, really depressing song, prayer, dirge that's specially engineered to worm its way into the melancholy receptors of the Semitic hindbrain and make you feel really, really, really miserable. Other people come over and cook for you, all 3 meals. You don't see yourself in the mirrors, you don't sit on cushions, you don't do anything except mourn for a whole week. Then it's over. You take a walk, leaving by one door and coming back in by the other. You put the mourning behind you and start in on your new life without your dear departed. You've given over your whole life for a whole week, done nothing but mourn, and you're completely sick of it by then, so you're almost glad to be done. Then, 6 months or a year later, usually just before Jewish New Year's, which is in the fall, you have a tombstone erected at the gravesite. The stonecutters tie a white cloth around it, and everyone gathers there, and there's the sermon, and that dirge again, and more prayer, and everyone has a good hard cry as the scabs you've accumulated are ripped away, and all your pain comes back fresh and scalding. And you feel it all again in one hot second, and realize with a guilty start that you have been neglecting the memory of your loved one, which is to say that you've gotten on with your life even though his is over, which is to say that you've done perfectly healthy, normal stuff, but you feel totally, completely overwhelmed with guilt and love, which are kind of flip sides of the same emotion. You don't believe that, do you? She held her breath. Well, kind of. Not that they should be, but hell, they are most of the time. Good thing we're not in love then, right? She said, in reference to their 6th date, when they decided that they would hold off on any declarations of love for at least an entire year, since they were most often moved to utter the 3 words of significance when they were besotted with, e.g., post-orgasmic brain juice or a couple of cocktails. Yes, counselor. She shook her head. He knew she was an academic and not a practicing lawyer, but he loved to tease her about it ever since she'd revealed, after the 3rd date on the phone, that she'd spent about 10 seconds in private practice, after she'd worked for her congressman and before she joined the faculty at UCLA. You're out of order, she said. The whole damn car is out of order, he said. So that's the ritual. You said you wanted to meet the parents and sisters and aunts and grandmothers and cousins and uncles and nephews and in-laws the next time we all got together. This is it. Right, she said. I asked for this. And she had, of course. hadn't asked for the graveside elements, but she'd been curious to meet this big, sprawling enterprise of a family he was always nattering on about. This seemed as good an occasion as any. "So," she said, "is this a traditional date among your people?" He chuckled. "Yes, this is Yom Shiksa, the ritual bringing of the Gentile woman to the family, so that she may become the subject of intense, relentless scrutiny and speculation." She started to laugh, and then saw the tractors that were stalled in the fields that they were passing, that a train was stopped on its tracks, that the surfers were unable to get their roll-cage dune buggies to take to the road. "You all right, babe?" he said, after a couple of minutes of this. "Just wondering about the dead spot," she said. "I wish we knew what had happened." "Nothing too bad, I'm sure. It's all self-healing. I'm sure we'll be back online soon enough."